Yeah, what's up with the lights? You've got some
It,
Exorcist thing
for some
going.
reason, it's Wi-Fi connected, so it will eventually stop flashing and just stey on.
Very
Sounds like
ominous.
a hypnotizer there, Max, into saying some awful things. You are
Hypnotoad.
feeling sleepy. You will say pro-Brexit things on our broadcast. We will get you.
Wonder what the legislation is for actual like there are methods of hypnosis that are a concern, like when you see that spinning wheel like in the Twilight Zone. Is there
Well,
actually any guidance for not trying to hypnotize your
there is, and I think the guidance is don't go back to flats with bad men in them because they will hypnotize you and then you'll say things you regret afterwards.
and demand money with menaces from a local Conservative Party officer. So
Absolutely.
it's a
Or they give out your
lose-lose.
phone number to top MPs.
It's a lose-lose situation.
Is that a full-size lose situation or a pint-size lose situation, Brendan, that you're thinking there?
I thought that it was slightly offensive what she had to say myself.
Do you know, I did at first, but I didn't actually understand the context because apparently that's an extract from Nadine Dorries's book, isn't it? Where she referred to him as that. So, because I thought, oh, Angela, that's a bit harsh for you, but I think she was just quoting from one of his own friends.
Are you really saying that because it's in Nadine Dorries's book, it's acceptable to say it?
Well,
I
I
hope
think
that's not the argument, Richard.
if you have a conservative minister talking about the people she was in office with, and she refers to the leader of their party, the person she briefly served with as chancellor, as a pint-sized loser, I think that is something that is worthy being in the public debate. Generally, I wouldn't criticize someone on that basis, but I think when a conservative minister has said it about another conservative minister, now the prime minister, it is news. And I think for the opposition to highlight it is appropriate. I think also that she suggested that Boris had been stabbed in the back, and that's something that Nadine Dorries has ranted and raved a
Absolutely.
lot about, so.
I suspect that's not Angela Rayner's personal view. I suspect she doesn't weep at night thinking how awful they were to Boris.
No, I think she thinks he was stabbed in the back and quite right too, doesn't she?
We don't condone any violence on this program.
Metaphorical, metaphorical.
He looked so sad there, Brendan, when I said that. They're
Although I
exceptional.
think Boris was stabbed in the front, not in the back. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Sunday Roast. And we are back with two wonderful guests once again. Richard, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, thank you for having me back, Max. My name is Richard Hewison. I'm the treasurer currently of the Rejoin EU Party, and I'm currently acting as agent for our team standing for the Assembly in the London elections.
Fantastic. Brendan.
I'm Brendan Donnelly. I'm, in theory, leader of the Rejoin EU Party, but it's a collective leadership in which Richard plays a very prominent role. I'm also standing for the London Assembly elections and looking forward to being able to salute the victory, in particular, of Richard, who's number one on our list when the results come out shortly after the 2nd of May.
Alex, my wonderful co-host, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm a YouTuber. I'm a political commentator. I'm a journalist, historian, and used to be a teacher. I'm also standing in the Assembly, so every vote does count. If you want to vote and you live in London and you trust my view on politics, then please do so. You'll see me in the third ballot. Max, my wonderful co-host, could you please introduce yourself?
My name is Max. I run the Robespierre channel where I talk about British politics and Brexit in particular. And I am not running in the London Assembly. So, Alex, can you tell us a bit about what's happening with the London Assembly?
So the London Assembly is having an election along with the London Mayor, and the London Assembly is divvied out into two sections. You've got the constituency that you can vote for, but there's a London-wide Assembly vote, and that's proportional. And the Rejoin EU Party is standing in that. And in the last election, we did all right. Richard, what happened in the last mayoral election that you?
Well, the last mayoral election, no, we did pretty good. We came 8th out of 20 with about 28,000 votes. On the assembly, the party list, we came 6th out of 18 with almost 50,000 votes. So, yes, that was quite a significant achievement. And to put a bit of context on it, we were going to run again for mayor this time around, but two factors came in the way. First of all, the Conservatives fixed the election basically by changing it back to first past the post in a shameless attempt, in my view, to skew the election towards their candidate. And we kind of felt, we don't really want to stand in an election like this, but we want to make sure there's a pro-EU voice. And then, of course, back in January, Mr. Khan suddenly made his amazing pro-EU speech, which I think caused Keir Starmer to choke on his morning croissants while listening to that. And we thought at that stage, well, actually, given that he is a very pro-EU voice, as is Zoe Garbutt, the Green candidate, we won't split the vote in this election. We won't stand. We'll step aside and we'll just focus on the Assembly. And so that's why we're standing in just the top-up portion of the Assembly. And for those who don't know how that works, it's basically proportional representation. You need 5% of the vote, and that gets you one seat on the Assembly. It complements the first-past-the-post electoral system as well. We argue that all we want is one out of 25 on the, obviously two would be better, but one out of 25 on the Assembly, so that we can propose to the Assembly that they reopen the issue of Brexit with Londoners, that they ask Londoners, what do you think about Brexit? We've got a general election coming up. Let's see what London says about how it feels about Brexit. And if we've got a more than 2% swing from 2016, then I think there's cause for the nation to reopen the debate.
In general, it'll be a marvellous platform to get into the Assembly of the London Assembly, because there are so many questions which are related to Brexit, which can be used as examples and proofs of the way Brexit isn't working. So I'm all in favour of consulting in an e-referendum or whatever you like to do it, the British, the London electorate. But it's a long-term project of having a voice in London, in the metropolitan newspapers, in the metropolitan media. It's ironic that there's been this attempt to skew the electoral system in favour of the Conservatives, because I think it's going to end up, particularly as the mayor, as far as the mayor election is concerned, but they're doing even worse than they needed to have done. And if you're going to put all your money, all your chips on that first past the post, I'd have thought it's incumbent upon you, rational, to get a decent candidate. And I don't think they've done that. So it's been a complete schmozzle on the Conservatives Party point of view.
Can I ask a question about the Liberal Democrats? They're not here to defend themselves, but they seem to have moved away from a pro-EU position. Is that right? Or is it just the leader?
That is a very... I'll try and be fair to the Liberal Democrats I speak to. Most of the Liberal Democrats I speak to, the ordinary members of the Lib Dem, could not be more pro-EU. And indeed, quite often when we bumped into them campaigning, particularly in by-elections, Chesham and Amersham resonates with me here. They come up to us and say, why are you standing against us? You know, we're pro-EU. And we say to them, well, Ed Davies said you're not a rejoin party. And they go, ah, yeah, Ed Davies. We talk to him, we tell him he's got to be better, but he's not. And my answer to them is, look, I know you're nice people, as that's why you're Liberal Democrats. I know you're nice people, but get rid of your useless leader. You have a proposition that's supported by almost 67% of the country now to rejoin the EU. And then they say, oh, yeah, but we can't change leader at this stage. And my answer is, you're on 9% in the opinion polls. How much worse can it get? Why not take a chance? Put a dynamic pro-EU leader in and let us know what you're about. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't heard much from the Lib Dem candidate in London, certainly nothing about their attitude to the EU. And I really think that is a good example of a party that really needs a shake and could do some great things for this country.
I think Nick Clegg injected into the Liberal Democrat Party the idea that they shouldn't just be identified with a limited number of proposals. PR and Europe were the two banner policies of the Liberal Democrats. And it's rather ironic. Both of those policies could be potentially very popular. But the Liberal Democrats have spent the past 10, 15 years talking ever less about either of them. Those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad, I think.
We had an interesting discussion a couple of weeks back in regards to the stealing of votes, the importance of small parties and third parties.
Don't use the phrase stealing of votes. Nobody owns votes. Votes have to be earned, and they're given to people who deserve them. The very idea of stealing votes is a shocking one to a Democrat.
I might get you to flip on that in a second.
Unless you're suggesting electoral fraud, for which you'd have to have good evidence.
Oh, that's a different proposition, Charlie.
Has Sadiq Khan stolen your policy? to get your 28,000 votes.
Well, look.
In which case, that you've actually done like quite a bit of interesting damage, because it's caused a bit of a rift in the Labour Party. Because I can see you. Go on, Richard.
Let's talk about this point. And it goes back to what I said about the last election, where we came sixth out of 18. And obviously, sixth might not sound great, but bear in mind, the four big parties, we were never going to beat them. So getting sixth place was pretty good. Now, if you're Sadiq Khan, it's January of an election year, you're looking down the list and you're thinking, right, OK, I'm not going to get any Tory votes. I'm not going to do well with the Lib Dems or the Greens. Where do I go for? The Women's Equality Party aren't standing. They were fifth. I talked to the sixth party, and there is a suggestion that maybe that was why he chose them to come out as very pro-EU, talking directly to our voters and saying, vote for me, I want us back in the EU. Now, to be quite frank, happy day, as far as I'm concerned. That's exactly what we want to do. And I'd love to claim credit for that. I think that might be going a little bit too far. But if we had any role in that decision, then that is a good result. And I want to just talk a little bit wider about this issue as well, because we're coming up to an election where all rational expectations are that Keir Starmer is going to have a three-figure majority in Parliament. And one of the things people are not asking themselves is where the opposition's going to be. You can't have good government without an effective opposition. And I hope that one of the sources of effective opposition is going to be Khan Towers in the middle of London, which is going to be broadcasting pro-EU messages to Labour activists that Keir Starmer needs to keep on board. So that's why I'm very happy with Mr. Khan's conversion.
The day after that speech that you referred to, he said in so many words, I support David Lammy's approach to the European Union. Now, David Lammy has been a great disappointment, just as much of a disappointment as Starmer, actually. Brexit is a matter that's decided. We're not going to bat him into the single market or the customs union. No freedom of movement. He's signed up for that agenda. Now, it's true that Chuck Khan is obviously chafing under those restrictions, but he is still a Labour candidate in good standing. And so it's absolutely fair to say that you expect more of Khan than Starmer. I would urge, don't get too enthusiastic or too optimistic about him, as long as he is a member of this Labour coalition, if you like.
No, but the words I would refer to that you just said there were the day after. Now, I'm pretty sure the day after that speech, there was various angry memos from a Starmerite direction to Mr. Khan, putting him under a lot of pressure. So I'm not surprised that there may have been a little bit of reverse pivot on that particular day. But for better or for worse, Khan has made his stake now in terms of where he stands on the EU debate. He's planted a flag that you can drag a little bit towards Starmer, but you can't really shift. And that, to me, is a promising sign.
Can I ask a question for both of you about the difference between London and the rest of the country when it comes to politics? So people, whether rightly or wrongly, view London as almost another country when it comes to policies and the primary issues. Is that true?
London itself is quite varied. It is wrong to say that all of London votes the same way. For instance, at the ULEZ question, I think in some of the outer boroughs and outer suburbs will be quite a powerful one and may mean that the Conservatives do better than they otherwise would. On the other hand, it is true that the big cities on the whole tend to be more open, more tolerant, more variegated. And of course, in London, there's a highly educated population, and education correlates statistically. I'm not making any moral judgment on it. Statistically, it correlates with being in favor of membership of the European Union and tolerant of foreign ideas and foreign cultures. I've been very amused approaching people on the street in London over the past few days, urging them to vote to rejoin EU. Some of the Caucasians turned out to be Danes or Australians and Germans. And some of the people who clearly aren't Caucasians have lived in London for 60 years and are very enthusiastic about rejoining the European Union. So it is a melting pot, if you like, and that's reflected in its attitude. A few years ago, Suzanne Evans, I think it was, the UKIP candidate or office holder talked about Europe as being about London as being an unfavorable place for UKIP because the people were too politically sophisticated and too educated. Well, how right she was! How right she was!
What about Susan Hall? Is she sophisticated enough?
Well, as we said, it's diversity in London, and one of the things about proportional representation is there's always going to be a proportion of the population that are Susan Halls. I'll say no further than that. And I think Susan Hall is their representative, but hopefully they will only get about 15 to 20% of the vote. Of course, that's the other big difference between London and perhaps the rest of England, it's fair to say. In common with Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, we do have a form of proportional representation, meaning that smaller voices are heard on the Assembly in London, as they are in the Scottish Parliament, as they are in the Welsh and Northern Ireland administrations as well. And it's not just first past the post as we get in many sort of council elections around the country, which naturally tends to reduce the diversity of voices that you hear.
One of the ways in which UKIP built up its political profile was by taking advantage of proportional representation elections, both in the European Parliament and in the London Assembly. So it's historically symmetrical that we should be attempting to reverse the process through the London Assembly.
It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, to be honest? If all the other systems are sort of rigged to make it a two-party system, essentially, maybe the Liberal Democrats in certain parts of the country would first pass the post. And then obviously that's within England. Obviously it's slightly different in other parts of the United Kingdom. It does make sense to go as much as you can proportional. To actually get a voice and get noticed, because you guys aren't getting any traction on mainstream media, which is bizarre because you are the only party that's outright saying, everyone else is saying, we'll eventually get there. You guys are saying...
Not everyone. The Conservatives aren't saying that. Reform aren't saying that. There are people, the Greens and the Liberal Democrats, who are saying it, but not everybody by any means.
I'm trying to say, like, directly wanting to go in as soon as possible. The Greens and the Lib Dems seem to have put it off into the long grass. Keir Starmer said absolutely no. Conservatives have. So why, you know, if the BBC are always about balance, how is it that you're not offered a platform, but other groups...
The BBC are not about balance, no. The BBC took the view after the 2016 referendum that Brexit was settled and we'll never discuss it again. So they'll talk about some of the problems of Brexit, but they will never discuss any alternatives to Brexit. And the Conservatives have appointed enough appointees to the BBC board to make sure that that echoes throughout. Now, I think the BBC, I don't want to be too unfair to the BBC, because I think journalists in general in this country have let the population down so badly. We talk about how awful our politicians are, and that's fairly obvious. But what is awful, what is also true, is how awful our journalists are. Our journalists lack the curiosity to explore anything other than the main themes that the big parties give them, and that has poorly let down the British public over the last few years. And it has meant we're in a situation where the most obvious solutions to our problems are ones that you will never hear in the mainstream media.
I'm a journalist.
Yeah. Do you work for the BBC, ITV, Sky or Channel 4? Or GB News? In that case, you're exempt.
Do you write for the Financial Times? Do you write for the Times? Do you write for any of the mainstream media?
Give it time.
In time, I'm sure. And I'm sure that will improve the standard enormously.
Have you actually been invited on any of the mainstream media to discuss this?
Not unless you count GB News. GB News invites us on regularly, but yeah, when you go on GB News, it's kind of the equivalent of the medieval when they want to put someone in stocks and throw things at them. We take the view, well, you know, different people have their views on GB News, and I totally respect those who say they don't want anything to do with an organisation like that. I take the view you never gain anything by not talking to the people you disagree with. So I'm always happy, might be an exaggeration, but prepared to go on GB News and see all the cabbages and rotten tomatoes come in my direction. But other than that, no, we will very rarely be invited on the mainstream media.
I've got to throw this over to Max. Max, did you see what Andrew Neil had to say about GB News?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, I did a video on it. It was very interesting. And he believes that, well, which was very interesting, because what was he expecting GB News to become? So he suggested that it is basically a channel run by nutters for nutters. So he told this to
quite a viable commercial model, perhaps.
Yes. A niche, but not a very profitable niche.
Not a profitable niche, no. which is interesting in itself, because you end up asking that question. Why did he set it up? How did he not realize that this was going to happen by setting up that model and having those people on? Stuff that they say. And Lawrence Fox was on there, wasn't he? For a little bit. Had a little piece.
And then he was kicked out. Yeah.
Did they have him as they had him as a presenter, didn't they?
That's right.
Dan Watson as well.
Yeah. Seems to be a story of his life, doesn't it? He gets into something and gets kicked out quite rapidly because he didn't do particularly well in the last mayoral election, did he?
Well, he did a lot better than this one. He actually managed to get his papers in, which it certainly was an achievement. I have to say,
is it complicated?
Let's be fair. That is a fair question, Max. I think I have a certain degree of sympathy with the difficulty of actually getting the papers in, because you do have to get 330 signatures, 10 from each borough. They have to be on the electoral register in that particular borough. You have to look up the electoral number, even though you can't get the electoral register until, I think it's the 1st of March, and then you have to have the papers in very, very quickly. So for a small party, it is complex to do. The other side of the equation is the London election authorities do realise that. So what they did was, a week before they even opened nominations, starting March the 11th, they had a consultation week where anyone could put their papers in and they would give feedback on whether those papers were wrong. They then opened nominations. I think it was on the, I must get the dates right. I think it was on the 17th they opened nominations, and they closed them on the 28th. And Lawrence Fox didn't even appear until the 27th, I think it was, with his papers, by which time it was too late to do it. So it's 50-50 on that one, really. I do sympathise that the barriers, and it's so unnecessary as well. I mean, when you talk to people for your 330 signatures, what you're basically saying is, will you let us stand in the election? We need your signature. And most people say, yeah, all right. It just takes up time, and it's not really a significant barrier to getting into the election. So, yes, it is very unfair on small parties. But apart from Lawrence Fox, everybody managed it, I think.
I think I'm going to have to give a shout out here, but Count Binface managed to do it.
Yeah.
He's now running twice. So, and he has no political party from what we understand of him. And having met him a couple of times, it's just him on his own. Like, there's no support network other than him shunting his face out there on media and everything to...
Well, Reclaim is an actual party, so they have people running it. It's not just Lawrence Fox on his own.
You need two people to run a political party, so it's Lawrence Fox and a mate, basically, I think.
Interesting. It's you'd think it'd be a lot more complicated as a system, but if Count Binface can do it...
Well, it's interesting to remind ourselves why we have to have political parties. We never needed to, but I think it was the 92 election that a few people put themselves on the ballot as conservative or conversative candidates to confuse conservative voters. And that's when it was made a rule that you have to be a political party or use the word independent when you stand. So,
well, you have to be a registered political party. You can be a political party, but if you want to contest elections, you have to register with the Electoral Commission.
Otherwise, you're just an independent.
It was quite amazing. I saw Keir Starmer's YouTube channel recently, but I also saw Count Binface.
He has a YouTube channel.
I was about to say the same. Really?
Yeah, it's terrible. We regularly get more views than Keir Starmer on YouTube, but you watch the videos and they're really great. It's back to the days of John Major and Spitting Image. Count Binface's video got 180,000 views.
Wow.
Which is for YouTube. I mean, that's incredible. I don't even know how he managed to do that. Rest of the videos, no, not that number. But
well, it's only going to get 180,000. But doesn't it say something about the lack of seriousness of too many people in the British electoral cycle, electoral participants who just are looking at somebody with a dustbin on his head, and that's it.
Well, yes.
Rather shocking, isn't it?
But when you look at the main two parties, if he was elected Prime Minister, could he do any worse? I would argue he couldn't. I'm not aware that he's got a policy of immediate nuclear launch on getting into Number 10 Downing Street. But short of that, I can't see how he could be worse than the current electorate. The current political parties in power. And I think that's a message that many voters want to actually give. I think the only message I would give back on that is, you're probably right, but perhaps a better thing to do is get involved with a party yourself. Start your own party if you think it's missing, but get involved with some rational party that you think expresses your view.
I always thought it was interesting to have that sort of, because you can't put, in some countries they allow you to put a big cross across the ballot paper to show, right, I can't vote for any of these parties. And I always felt that Count Binface or Lord Buckethead or the Monster Raving Loony Party actually allowed that process to happen, where you're going, I'm just not satisfied with anyone. And then when that comes into data, you can go, right, there's obviously a gap in the market. And arguably, you know, we can say that gap in the market was exploited during Brexit through Cambridge Analytica, who found supposedly 3 million votes of people who were supposedly disenfranchised. So I've always it's quite funny to watch. You don't ever take it seriously, but at the same time, as you said, it says something about the political discourse. You also had, and this is in itself is quite interesting, you had Nico and Max Fosch run in the mayoral election. Nico came fifth, didn't he, as an independent, yeah, which was interesting itself. So he got about 49,000 votes. Arguably, those parties running was part of the reason why the Conservatives switched the voting system to first past the post, to clear that out. So it stopped people from voting for independents like Nico or Max and Rejoin and...
Well, I'm not so sure of that. I think it's more to put them off standing than to actually cost the votes, because for people like Nico and Max in the previous election, and us as well, it was a cost-free exercise in terms of political capital, because we could say, look, you now have the option as an elector to use your first vote for what you truly believe in. And then, so vote with your heart for the first vote, vote with your head for the second vote. And that, I think, was something a lot of Londoners actually valued at the time. And that's been taken away now. It doesn't stop people like that standing. It just means that if they do stand, they are aware that their voters actually won't be able to make a difference between the final two in any election.
I think Alex Drake makes the important point that some of these people who vote for Binface or whoever it is, are doing so as in order to demonstrate their discontent with the political and party system. But I have a theory about why that is, which is because the parties are themselves obsessed with focus groups, of saying what they think will please a particular tranche of the electorate, and particularly the swing voters, because Brexit and a lot of other political discourse now, Rwanda, Keir Starmer's guilty of it, is directed towards the 10 or 15% of the electorate who they think may be persuadable to change from last time. And while that seems very clever and politically sophisticated in the short term, what it does is undermines any sort of philosophical or political coherence to the message of the parties. And when people say, oh, I've no time for politicians, they'll say anything in order to get elected. One of the reasons why they're doing that is because they're trying to persuade people like you that you should vote for them. It's a peculiar irony that attempting to anticipate every whim of the electorate, in fact, makes the electorate even more suspicious of the political parties, because they think they lack any fundamental commitment to values, which they may not initially share, these voters, but at least they respect and take seriously the people who advocate coherently a philosophical worldview.
It's very interesting when it comes to Labour, because they recently, well, a few years ago, were supportive of nationalisation of the railways. Then they didn't. Then they binned the idea, and now they seem to be embracing it once again.
Well, I think it's possible that is the beginning of a realisation by Starmer and his advisers that he has much more political space to carve out a traditionally Labour view, which I wouldn't necessarily personally share, but there is a much more of a market for it than he sometimes realises, because some of the verities of the Thatcherite era are now being much more questioned than they were over the past 40 years. And perhaps that will extend to Europe as well, because the hesitation about nationalisation has been very much not wanting to offend the middle ground of people who supposedly would regard that as socialistic and communistic and the sort of thing that Jeremy Corbyn would have wanted to do. I think this may be an opportunity for Keir Starmer to wake up and sniff the coffee.
I think that's so true. And also with this, one of the big criticisms I think many of us have had with Keir Starmer over the last few years is he doesn't seem to stand for anything. He just sort of knows to anything else. Finally, this is actually a policy that Labour voters can potentially identify with. And for that reason, I think it is quite a good move on Starmer's part. Also, every time between now and the general election now, someone is caught up in a stopped train, a train strike on TfL, a grumpy journey where they stopped at 25 stops, they're going to think, oh, yeah, I'm going to vote for the railways to change. So I think it's actually a good social move as well as a political one.
Phil was bringing that up last week. A couple of weeks back now, saying that Phil, from a different bias, who's part of Labour Social, was definitely saying that people want it to be nationalised, but when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of how to do that, that's where they change their mind. It's almost like, and David Hennig, who's been on the show repeatedly, has said this, we want Scandinavian services, but we want American taxes to provide it. And it's never possible to do that.
Could we apply that also to rejoining the EU, that many people say, look, we're not happy with Brexit, but, well, I don't want to drop the pound, or I don't want to return to freedom of movement, or so. This is me just playing devil's advocate here, but is it a difficult sell? Like, it's an easy sell. Brexit is a problem, but rejoining the EU, is that a more difficult sell?
Well, this is where I think the movement in the opinion polls has been most interesting, because many of us might think, oh, currently we're showing 60-odd% for wanting to rejoin. Wasn't it 60-odd% 2 or 3 years ago? Well, the question has subtly changed. 2 years ago, we were asking people, was Brexit a mistake? And that's where we were getting majorities in the 62, 63 area. The question has now changed to, do you want to rejoin the EU? That's what a lot of pollsters are asking now. And we are still seeing majorities in that sort of area for that. I think if you just put the basic question, should we go back to the EU? I think you would get an overwhelming yes. But like Alex was saying with the trains, yes, a lot of the nuts and the bolts and the details will cause people to question. The pound may be a big argument in that, but I would say one of the big things we should do with the pound is stop calling it the pound. Let's call it what it is. It's the ATP, because that's what it's worth now compared to what it was when we went out of Europe in 2016. You could call it the 65p if you take into account inflation. So,
are the 30p's? that's a different.
If we rebased decades ago, I'm sure we could get there. But let's go back to 2016 when we made the decision, and I'm not going to stretch truth too much further. So the pound has lost so much of its spending power, both at home and abroad, since then, that pegging us with a stable continental currency like the euro could be a very good move in many people's eyes.
When the question is put, would you want to give up the pound? That invites the answer, I don't want to give up the pound. Would you like to join the euro? And particularly if that put in a context of lower inflation, lower interest rates, greater stability, then you'll get a different answer. It's very striking that there's been evolution been taking place of opinion, which Richard rightly points to. First, it was anti-Brexit, Brexit isn't working. Now it's beginning to be a view to rejoin. It's not an established and based one. It's more an intuitive feeling at the moment. But with a debate that focused on the real issues, and which didn't fight shy of saying, yes, freedom of movement is a very good thing. Joining the euro could be a very good thing. Joining the customs union is a very good thing. I think these are arguments that could be won, and it would be a pleasant surprise for the politicians who tried to win them how easy it would be in the medium term, not in the short term necessarily, but in the medium term to win these arguments.
Do you feel that's the same with the mobility package that the Commission offered the UK for 18 to 30-year-olds?
The Commission didn't offer anything to the UK. It asked the Council of Ministers to approve a proposal. There is no proposal from the EU. It's only the Commission. It's an internal debate within the European Union. I've been amused at some of the comments on it from the outside, which have said, oh, this isn't suiting the British. This isn't suiting Keir Starmer. We wish it had been this. We wish it had been that. How can you possibly expect an organisation that you've left particularly in the rancorous circumstances which we left the European Union, to make proposals or talk about proposals simply in the light of what the British or part of the British establishment might want. The Commission have put forward this proposal to the Council of Ministers because they're worried that the British are approaching individual countries in the hope of having favourable arrangements with those individual countries. And what the Commission have said to the Council of Ministers, isn't it better if we do it all together, if we have some sort of coherence between our arrangements? And we'll see what the Council of Ministers say. I think they probably will endorse something like this package. But the package is framed in a way that very much suits the European Union. I can understand that people who want a British positive response might say there are elements of it we'd want to renegotiate. But that wasn't what the Labour Party said. What the Labour Party said was, this sounds too much like freedom of movement. And it's got very, very little to do with freedom of movement. It's a minuscule element of the problems with the absence of freedom of movement. And what I'm afraid of is that the Labour Party might come into power and then spend 5 years renegotiating a mobility package. And that's 5 years before we've really broached the question of rejoining, which is what we need to do, not simply to argue about the national health surcharge for people under 30 to come to this country.
I think Brendan is totally spot on with that. And I think it's worth saying exactly why it is not freedom of movement as well. Freedom of movement used to allow us to relocate our lives anywhere we wanted in Europe, to move our jobs, to move our families and be there forever. The terms of this was basically a four-year deal aimed at young people. And we might think, oh, that's great. Let our young people have 4 years exploring Europe. That's going to be great. But it means they're going to rebase their lives into Europe. And at the end of 4 years, they're going to find themselves unwanted aliens, splitting up whatever relationships and possibly family they have now to send them back to the UK. So Brendan's absolutely right. This is not freedom of movement. In fact, this is very inferior to freedom of movement and needs to be looked at very, very carefully, in my view.
Within those 4 years, though, those people would be able to claim for residency if they've got a job and everything else. Is that not part of the point of the...
No, I think the idea was that that the 4 years could count towards a claim for citizenship or whatever it is they might want. But it's a very inferior arrangement compared to what we have at the moment and might well take up a lot of political bandwidth and negotiating time in order to arrive in 4 or 5 years' time at something that's much worse than we had before, and which is only a very small part of the spectrum of Brexit disbenefits.
Exactly.
No, I just wanted to ask a question of both of you, because I tend to see a lot of commentary online from Remainers or Rejoiners who seem to believe that the European Union needs to do Britain a favour in some way. I don't know if you'd noticed that yourself, that a lot of people seem to think that it's, well, you know, the European Union needs to go that extra mile to convince people in Britain that it would be a good idea to rejoin. And I
agree there's a lot of barking up the wrong tree, but I think that's a slightly harsh way of putting it. I just think that a lot of British rejoiner or remainer opinion can't understand that being outside the European Union is something fundamentally different from being inside the European Union. It's a very simple point. But whereas when Britain, when the United Kingdom was in the European Union, it was in a position to go to Macron or to go to the President of the Commission or the President of the Council and say, it would help us if you did this or didn't do this now, if you did it next week rather than today. And that would be taken into account. We didn't always get our own way, but we were quite good at having our voice heard. When you're not at the table, when you're not in the European Union, then what you think, what you would like to have happen, isn't really at issue. It's the internal dynamics of the European Union which lead to its taking one decision or another. And that, I think, is quite difficult for many British commentators who still think there's some sort of equality between the European Union and the United Kingdom, and that there's a constant negotiation going on between them where the European Union has just as much or perhaps even more to take account of what the British might be worried about. It just doesn't work that way and can't work that way. I rather had the impression when looking at the commission proposal, which may or may not be accepted by the council ministers, that they very definitely had the expectation that if there is going to be an agreement on this issue, it will be more largely on the European terms, on the EU terms, rather than on the British terms. Whereas a lot of British commentators expect, well, we'll get into a negotiation and we'll settle somewhere in between the two positions. I don't think that that's the way the EU sees it. The way the EU sees it is that it's a bigger, more populous, more important geopolitical actor than is the United Kingdom. And if the United Kingdom can make up its mind that it wants to be in relationships and negotiations with the EU, that's fine. But they're not going to pretend that they think of themselves as being on the same level as a small, medium-sized neighbour, which stormed out of the European Union relatively recently.
Interesting. I guess there's that issue within the UK where you don't really want to, if you're running as a political party or you're in charge of the government, you don't really want to make yourself out to be smaller than the EU. And in fact, you generally do want to be in a position, it's like a game of poker, isn't it? You want to make your hand look bigger than it actually is in order to convince the person that you've got a negotiating position.
Sure, but I think the way in which the Brexit negotiations convinced the EU, and this was one of the other factors I should have mentioned, that they will usually be able to run rings around British negotiators, because the British negotiators have got so many contradictory ideas going on in their mind about what Brexit is, what it should be, what Britain's position in the world is. The British have spent a lot of time talking about their special relationship with America. They think of themselves sometimes as having a special relationship with the European Union as well. And I'm afraid that's gone now that we've left.
I just think it was so strange that they decided to put David Frost in charge because he believed in Brexit, not because of his competence in doing the job.
Well, Max, I think this is another thing that we forget about Brexit as well, because when it comes to who was on what side during the Brexit debate, all the top economists or people with genuine social understanding, emotional intelligence were generally on the Remain side. The people on the Brexit side, and I'm sorry to say this, were fundamentally of a lower quality. And one of the consequences of Brexit is we have lower quality MPs forming a lower quality government on the Conservative side. So it's not particularly surprising you get people like Frost negotiating, because he's the best there is on the Brexit side. And that's not really saying too much. And I think it leads on to the lower standards that we've got used to in our public life since Brexit as well. We now accept MPs and ministers who don't know their briefs, can't really understand what they're talking about, make gaffes right, left and centre, things that 20 years ago you would have expected a minister to resign over. That's the reality we've got. And I'm afraid that is also down to Brexit.
Brendan, you used to be a member of the European Parliament for the Conservative Party, right?
Yes, I did.
And how do you look at the current caliber of politicians today and compare it with the times when you were in the European Parliament?
Well, it's a terrible temptation to look back and think, well, everything was better in my day. And in particular, I was better in my day than these people today. So I'm very hesitant about saying that. I don't necessarily think that the individuals are any better or worse. You shouldn't romanticize the people in the past. But I do think that something fundamentally changed in British political culture with the success of the Leave element campaign in 2016. It was that you could engage in the wildest fantasy and lies, and Cummings admitted that many of the figures that he was putting forward were plucked out of thin air, but it was done in order to generate a debate, and he thought that was worth doing, and it turned out to be successful. I think it's very difficult for jobbing politicians not to draw the conclusion from that. My career will be advanced if I follow these examples, and if I worry too much about whether something's literally true or whether it can be based on evidence, well, that's not going to help my career. I don't share your surprise that someone like Frost should be the negotiator for Brexit. Who else could they get? It's not unreasonable for a government to want to have somebody who believes in the mad project that it's going forward to negotiate it. It's just that will have the consequences that you've pointed to. But Brexit can only be sustained by the denial of its consequences. That's why we have 63% of people who say they want to rejoin, because they realize it can't be made to work. But I can understand why a government committed to Brexit would want somebody negotiating it who believed in it, who shared their delusions.
Over competence.
Competence doesn't really enter into it. It's not to do with competence. It's to do with feeling better about yourself. That's what Brexit is about.
But isn't that then plugging... But that's a feeling over logic. I mean, Christ, I could go back to Socrates talking about the issues of feelings over logic. It's been debated over 3,000 years, and the general consensus is you don't go over a feeling, you go for the logical move, which is...
On the contrary, the consensus is that human history is littered with examples of people preferring emotions over logic.
Is that what happens
when things go wrong in history?
Is that why the Leave campaign was so... the Remain campaign in 2016 was such a disaster, because it was based on figures and logic and reason?
I think it was also complacency as well, if we're honest, Max, because nobody believed that Britain could be mad enough to vote for Brexit. And I certainly share my share of the blame there. I had my feet up on the sofa throughout the whole referendum. I was laughing. I remember laughing when I saw the leaflet come through the door about Turkey joining the EU and the big queue. And I was just thinking, oh, no one's ever going to believe that. What a shock. So, yes, to a certain extent, there was a reliance on figures and logic over emotions. We didn't at the time explain all the benefits that we got from EU membership. But I think it's also a case both on both sides. Nobody expected Leave to win. So what Brendan's saying about them sort of making up figures for a debate, if you think you're going to lose by a clear margin, obviously you do that. You're just unlucky if you win, and then you're proved to be liars in the worst possible way for all of us.
But I think it wasn't just a question of figures against emotion. It was the fact that many of the people on the Remain side during the campaign were pointing to various opt-outs and various special arrangements for the United Kingdom as if they were the only things which made membership of the European Union tolerable. There was always this... thought in the background, well, we don't want to get too far involved in the European Union because there are some very dangerous and unattractive aspects to it. Whereas the message of the UKIP people, the people who wanted to leave, was much clearer. We want out of this rotten organisation. There weren't people saying, or there weren't very many people saying, we want to stay in this marvellous organisation. And I think it was the absence of that that... tilted the balance, because so many people were saying, of course, I don't believe in a federal Europe. I don't believe in a United States of Europe. I don't believe in this. I don't believe in that. I'm glad we've got all these opt-outs. We're not going to join the single currency, not going to join Schengen. When you've hedged it all about with these caveats and I don't want to do this and I don't want to do that, it's much more difficult to enthuse people for remaining in the European Union.
But then that comes back to the emotive language, doesn't it? Because it's the hesitancy behind it, which means that you don't have belief in what you're saying. It's a bit like, again, you know, looking back historically, it's a bit like FDR and his bank speech. Imagine if it had been half-hearted, it wouldn't have had the impact, because he was saying, look, you've got to trust the banks. You've got to put your money in there. Like, we're going to guarantee it. But imagine if he'd gone in half-hearted, like, well, you know, we don't want to help them out too much, but...
if we do, it'll
probably be a good thing.
Commitment is a powerful political weapon. And there was more of it on the Leave side than there was on the Remain side.
I think there is something in what Alex says about emotions, though, as well. And I think, unfortunately, the emotional response was geared around five individuals in that referendum. On the Leave side, we had Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, who were both great at galvanising, enthusing and motivating their crowd. Unfortunately, on our side, we had Tony Blair, Nick Clegg and David Cameron, who between them were three of the most loathed figures at the time. And indeed, one thing we forget, how many people told you the day after the referendum how pleased they were to have knocked the smile off David Cameron's smug face? That was a motivation for quite a lot of people going into that election. Obviously, Tony Blair was a questionable historic figure who was very big on the Leave side. And Nick Clegg had pretty much just betrayed an entire generation over tuition fees. So when he was saying vote to stay in the EU, virtually a whole generation was saying, if that guy's in favour of it, I'm in the opposite direction. So yes, I think you're right. There was emotions behind it. And perhaps those emotions were enough to make the difference between 16.1 and 17.4 million. But underlying that, I think there was quite a lot of dispassionate logic on the Remain side.
So I'm going to throw out, what is the emotive message from the Rejoin EU party? That's, what have you learned from that and putting forward for this campaign?
I'll let Brendan have that one.
I think it's that if this country is to have a coherent sense of itself, it can't be outside the European Union, because as long as it's pretending it's not a European country, that it's like either America or Australia or the Pacific, it will be ensnared in self-delusion that will make us an unhappy and eventually an unviable country. That's also the point that at the time of political dissonance and danger in Europe, coming principally from Russia, why on earth at that point would we want to be further away from our allies and neighbours than we ever have been in the recent past? So those are the two points I'd make. Our identity, who we are, and what we can contribute to European solidarity in a very dangerous and unstable time.
Say, from my point of view on the emotional side, the only thing I've really got out of this, I've tried a number of different approaches in the street with people with leaflets to engage in conversation. And I found the only emotional way to engage people is to use the same four words every time. Hello, Brexit isn't working. And that is where many people will pivot on their heel and react emotionally to what you're saying. People who are going to walk past you before that. So people now associate Brexit with a passion. Most people a negative passion, some people a positive passion. And for me, I think that's very telling.
I think people like Farage and the Brexiteers have an uphill journey to climb, because they're trying to sell this idea that Brexit is positive, but there's nothing positive. They can't point to anything positive. And they can't use positive emotions, because people are looking around and saying, no, well, things have not improved since we've left. Things have got much worse. So while I think in 2016, they were able to say, look, as soon as we leave, we're going to have these sunlit uplands. But now that it has all come crashing down, they can't rely on positive emotions anymore. And I think this is something, and I'm not saying it to be dishonest, but I think it's something that Rejoin EU could use, say, look, remember the good old days. Remember when you used to be able to travel around Europe. Remember when, as a business owner, you were able to sell into the single market and they were able to sell to you. I think
remember when you didn't have to pull your own teeth out.
Yes.
I think that's part of identity, that the more natural way in which Europeans should interact with each other is in the European Union. It's not us against them. It's not us pretending that somehow we're an exception. I think it's a recipe for an unhappy country as long as we're going to be outside the European Union, because we won't know who we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I know I've been mocked for saying it before, but I will say it again. To me, if you look back at 2012, Britain was paradise on earth in 2012. Remember the year of the Olympics? We had this dodgy coalition government we weren't quite sure about then. But everything worked. Everything was looking for the up. People felt proud of the country that they were in. Life was great. We tolerated our neighbours. We didn't hate each other the way a lot of people seem to now. So, yes, I think that's something we lost ourselves with. I think there's other things. I take 2012 for a reason, because I actually think 2014, when Russia first invaded Crimea and the information war started, is when things started going down. But yes, we've lost a lot. And I worry about being one of those old men, as Brendan says, who says, oh, when I was a lad, it was great. But in my entire life, I guess my conscious memory goes back to about 1970. From 1970 to 2012, it was generally an upward movement in society. I didn't perceive it as regressing. It was generally one way, and that way was always better. A few reversals.
But also people believed that things would continually get better.
Absolutely.
And I think that all came crashing down in 2016.
It did.
Just as we were recovering from the 2008 crash, which is interesting. Just as we were coming out of that.
which in its effect actually wasn't as bad as everyone perhaps feared at the time. We had some economic turbulence over the period, but quite frankly, it was nothing compared to what we've had since Brexit.
I'm going to give you three leaders. Pick the one that you think that you would prefer the most to be in power.
Mm-hmm.
Lord, so this will go over to Richard. Lord Buckethead, Liz Truss, Boris Johnson.
Well, obviously Lord Buckethead, because he would clearly far. He's the only one who I could think might have a positive chance. Why would you have two proven losers and someone you've not given a chance to? So it would have to be Lord Buckethead every single time.
I can't improve on that.
Well, you've got three different. We've got three different people for you.
Oh, I see. Okay,
Lord Buckethead.
That's not three Trump. Different people.
Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Well, if you're going to put such a limited field of competitors to Lord Buckethead, he has to win every time, I'm afraid. I can't believe that I would find anything out about Jacob Rees-Mogg or Donald Trump that would make me inclined to support them as a supreme leader of the universe, whereas I might be pleasantly surprised by Lord Buckethead when he takes off his bucket.
Max.
Oh, please don't do that. He might turn out to be Donald Trump underneath. That would be a lot too much.
Max, I'm gonna be evil. Okay, Max, okay. I'm sorry. Boris, Trump, Putin.
Oh, yeah, once again, Boris, because at least I think, well, I disagree with a lot of things. I think in many ways he was trying to do the right thing, but
you really think so?
Not. I'm struggling here.
But you do have to ask yourself, what is the political and institutional context in which this person is exercising his malevolent power? Trump and Putin are in Russia and America, and they have a much greater power of doing evil in the world than Boris did when he was prime minister. So I would say Boris. Sorry to get in again, but I do think you can't just take these people in isolation. You have to look at the context in which they might be politically active.
Thank you, Brandon, for saving me.
Yeah. I think you have to give one back to Alex. So, Alex, I'm going to give you three.
I will take that in a second, but I will take that. I will just say this, though. Boris, Putin, and Trump all have access to the nuclear button, and all three have about 6 minutes to 30 seconds to make a decision about a retaliatory firing of nuclear missiles.
Do you really think it would work that way for the British? I don't myself.
In terms of...
Well, the Americans could stop it if they wanted to.
No, but I mean, they'd be able to launch from the nuclear subs.
Would they? Would they? That's not sure at all. That's not sure at all.
I know we're segueing. I will take the question. There was a report claiming that Russia had developed nuclear torpedoes that could blow up underneath the water, which would create gigantic tidal waves. That came out. They're called Poseidon torpedoes. Mm-hmm. Anyone heard of it? Yeah, I mean, you're talking like they'd be able to create tidal waves off the coast, which is just, I mean, that level of technology is quite crazy. And the fact that Putin has access to that.
In actual fact, the terrifying thing is you need a relatively small nuclear device detonated in a strategic part of the Canary Islands to cause a tsunami that would simultaneously wipe out the east coast of America and most of Western Europe at the same time. So we are on a knife edge where lots of maniacs have options to do really bad things to us.
What were my three?
Okay, so three for you, Alex. I'm going to give you Stalin. I'm going to give you Pol Pot. And I'm going to give you Donald Trump.
Right, you're going to hate me for this, but you can at least say that Donald Trump hasn't been involved in a genocide. So Stalin killed probably more people under his regime than Hitler. Ooh. So that's chilling. And he's still considered a great leader. Ooh. Pol Pot, I think he was killing people for just wearing glasses, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Just wearing glasses.
Get those glasses off, Richard.
And then
he believed they were intellectuals. So
I mean, as mad as he was, the fact that he attempted a coup, and he's done more damage to democracy in the United States in 250 years than any foreign adversary. You could probably argue he didn't have any wars in his 4 years.
Would you not hold him responsible for at least part of the scale of the COVID crisis in the US, and particularly his advice to do things like take bleach?
Yeah. I mean, his advice to take bleach was just totally out there. The fact that Nigel Farage defended that as well and tried to suggest that disinfectant isn't bleach. I mean, that was just, that was really mad. And you could see, there was a clip where you see him, Donald Trump, reading the info board before he comes on stage and saying that, and it clearly says disinfectant kills the virus. So you get the impression that he was insane enough to want to come up with the answer that solves the problem with COVID, that he was taking random scraps of information with no biological or medical knowledge and suggesting it to the population. I think two people actually ended up taking the bleach because of that. And I think the CDC and another organization had to tweet out immediately afterwards, do not drink bleach, to countermand the president. I mean, so it's really, thanks for that.
Yeah,
I'm going to go with Pol Pot because you've got glasses on. Sorry, I shouldn't have that.
Oh, that's nice. So just to save me, you'll go for Pol Pot. To hell with everybody else. Thank you, Alex.
I think in solidarity with Richard, I'm putting on my glasses.
Solidarity. I think the thing with Trump, though, as well, is that when he made that announcement, I think what you're right is connect the information, that he thought, I'm a pure genius. I'm going to go down in history for solving the COVID crisis. That probably went through his mind just before he said it.
He also said putting UV light into the body, which is something else that not many people brought up. But he said UV light, which UV light damages the skin, and our skin is designed to withstand a certain amount. So if you put it against tissue that hasn't got skin against it, you're like, right, that's insane.
Internal burns. Ouch.
Internal burns. Like, he was suggesting that you just burn it out. I mean, he's literally suggesting like a...
Please don't tell me there's any record of anyone taking a fluorescent tube into themselves
horrible set of options. On that fantastic and fun note, thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks for having us.
Goodbye.
Be sure to tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.